You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the Philippines, Vice President Sara Duterte is facing an impeachment trial. Her political enemies accuse her of corruption and plotting to kill the president.
They're moving heavens and high waters because they know that she is really formidable.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, we take you to Haiti, where people have had to flee their homes to escape gang violence.
In my house, he says, we spent 2 or 3 weeks crying. The water couldn't stay in our eyes.
Plus, a group of fathers go on strike to demand more paid paternity leave.
And South Korea's juggernaut boy band.
BTS is everything for me, because for me, BTS is my angel.
Military service nearly done. The boys are headed for a reunion.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. We start today in Southeast Asia, in the Philippines, where one of the region's most bombastic political dynasties could be facing Judgment Day. An impeachment court in the Philippines was supposed to kick off hearings today against Sara Duterte, but is holding back for now because of legal questions.
Sara Duterte is the current vice president of the country. Her father is Rodrigo Duterte, the former president who is being held at the International Criminal Court in The Hague for overseeing a violent war on drugs. That leaves Sara Duterte as the family's main hope for possible redemption. The World's Patrick Nguyen gets us started.
Politicians love to call themselves fighters, but Sara Duterte can back it up. 13 years ago, when she was mayor of a large city called Davao, the local sheriff wanted to tear down an illegal shanty town. She said that was unfair to the local poor. So on demolition day, with TV cameras rolling, Sara Duterte stepped to the sheriff and gestured, like, hey, buddy, come a little closer. That's Sara Duterte wailing on the sheriff until he doubled over in pain. The crowd of shanty dwellers loved it. And so did many Filipinos watching on TV.
She hit the guy really, really hard.
Professor Froilan Kalilung is a political scientist with the University of Santo Tomas.
It's not only her demeanor, but her brute strength as well that sets her apart from the other politicians in the country.
Those punches made Sara Duterte famous in the Philippines. And it's kind of a political Rorschach test. Some see a person clearly unfit to lead. But many others see a bare-knuckle patriot standing up for the little guy.
This is the Duterte brand of politics that endeared them closer to the masses. They say whatever they want to say, and they do deliver it with a considerable level of action as well.
Sara Duterte, 47 years old, is the vice president. In the Philippines, VPs are elected separately from the president. She now faces impeachment for bribery, misuse of taxpayer dollars, and then there's the big one. 6 months ago, in a video address, she said she feared political elites would have her killed, but said if that happens, she's already lined up an assassin to kill the House Speaker, the First Lady, and Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the president himself.
Sinabi ko sa kanya, kapag pinatay ako, patayin mo si BBM, si Lisa Araneta, at si Martin Romales. No joke. No joke.
No joke, she said. The Dutertes are a political machine. The patriarch, ex-president Rodrigo Duterte, rose to power by vowing to take on stuffy political aristocrats and purify poor neighborhoods by killing drug dealers. Tens of thousands of deaths later, he's awaiting trial at The Hague. But still so popular, he was recently elected mayor of his hometown from his cell. Sara Duterte has two brothers, one a mayor, another in Congress, but they lack their father and sister's charisma. Sara is the real star now. And she's expected to run for president in 2028, and maybe win, unless she gets impeached, which comes with sanctions.
The very interesting and politically charged sanction is disqualification from any public office forever.
That's Aries Arugay, a political scholar with the University of the Philippines. He says senators, with heavy bias, will decide her fate, not judges. Those seeking to ban Sara Duterte are aligned with another political dynasty, that of President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. His father is ex-dictator Ferdinand Marcos Sr. His mother is a former first lady, the ex-congresswoman and footwear enthusiast Imelda Marcos. Professor Kalilung sees the impeachment not so much as a quest for justice, but as a political maneuver by Team Marcos with one crystal clear goal.
Finally eradicating Sara Duterte from the picture so that she will not be able to run anymore. They're moving heavens and high waters because they know that she is really formidable.
But Arugay at the University of the Philippines says not so fast. Only during the trial will everyone see all the evidence against Sara Duterte. There may be some bombshells. And if she is impeached, will Sara go quietly? That's not the Duterte style.
In the Philippines, we could go in deep constitutional crisis mode and be in a downward spiral of political instability, which I hope will not happen.
Sara Duterte's attorneys have tried to halt the impeachment. But at public events, to reporters, Sara keeps saying, bring it on. Bring on the trial. Bring on the bloodbath.
It's some sort of crucifixion against me. When there's a crucifixion, there's blood. So it's a bloodbath, my bloodbath.
Yep, it may be a dramatic summer in the Philippines. The Senate probably won't present evidence until next month and may not issue a verdict on Sara Duterte until October. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Parts of Iceland and Greenland saw record-breaking temperatures last month, which led to much more melting on the Greenland ice sheet than usual for part of May. That's according to a scientific analysis out today. Those high temps would have been nearly impossible without climate change. To understand what's happening in the far north and what the impact could be, we called up Nicholas Fokel. He's assistant professor at the University of Georgia's Skidaway Institute of Oceanography.
It was particularly warm. This was characterized mostly by atmospheric temperature, but also by sea surface temperature of the ocean. And so it triggered some anomalous melting over the Greenland ice sheet in May that's typically not seen until sort of end of June or early July type behavior. But that this was an anomalous event over the Greenland ice sheet and could potentially have impacts elsewhere in the ocean and the atmosphere.
Can you remind us exactly what the Greenland ice sheet is and how big it is?
So it's just a massive ice that's 3 kilometers, up to 3 kilometers thick on Greenland. And it has about just over 7 meters of sea level rise equivalent of fresh water on it. So it's a potential source of sea level rise, and it's an important part of our climate system.
So what that means is that if all of the Greenland ice sheet were to melt, which is not something we're talking about happening, or anytime soon at least, that would contribute 7 meters to global sea level rise, which is what, like 21-ish feet?
Roughly speaking, yes. As you mentioned, this is not supposed to happen in the next few centuries, but it does have that much ice on it, and it's remarkable how thick it is. So it's Greenland is a relatively small geographic region compared to how it looks on some Mercator projections of maps. But it has a remarkable amount of ice on it. And that's due to how thick the ice is.
Mm. So because of these hot temperatures in May, preliminary numbers suggest that melting over about a week-long period on the Greenland ice sheet in mid-May was 17 times higher than average for that time of year. That does not sound good, but how significant do you, as an expert, see that as?
Well, so it's, May is right when the melt season starts. And so it is quite a bit higher than normal, but it's kind of characteristic of what conditions we would see in June or July. So it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility over the course of a year. It's just remarkable that it's happening in May, so early in the season.
And is that in and of itself significant? I mean, does it matter that it is happening in May instead of later on in the summer?
Definitely. So the timing of the freshwater input to the ocean is really critical for its impacts on the large-scale circulation. So one of the things that we see in our studies around southern Greenland is that the timing of when the freshwater arrives to southern Greenland is pretty critical for how it impacts the stratification and the circulation around southern Greenland.
Interesting. This kind of gets to my next question, which is, I have heard this phrase many times, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. And you mentioned ocean circulation. How does that apply when we talk about melting on the Greenland ice sheet?
Yes, this is something we're always interested in with Greenland ice sheet melting, is how it is impacting the large-scale North Atlantic circulation, or the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which is the AMOC, or sometimes called the AMOC for short. And definitely the timing, the seasonal timing of that freshwater is quite anomalous this year. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that might impact the AMOC. We don't necessarily know or have any predictions as to right now what impact it would have. But if this melting continues throughout the year, it would equate to one of the largest years of freshwater input to the Atlantic, which is pretty concerning for the stability of the AMOC and, you know, where we expect it to go in the next few years.
So does this early May melting mean anything for, you know, the stability of that important ocean current?
It's unclear. It's certainly going to be interesting to see if it has an impact. I think that the key is, so this fresh water leaves the Greenland ice sheet and it goes into the continental shelf waters. And there's a very strong coastal circulation called the coastal currents, the East Greenland Coastal Current and the West Greenland Coastal Current. And that typically keeps that fresh water up against the coast of Greenland. The question is whether that fresh water can then get out into the interior of the North Atlantic, the subpolar North Atlantic. And so if it gets off the continental shelf, that's when we start to worry about its impact on the large scale. So just the fact that this fresh water is coming into the coastal circulation so early in the year is worrying, but it's not the end effect, or there's still some other steps that need to happen in order for it to have a large scale impact.
So like with so much else, you got to kind of wait and see what the bigger impact is here.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that the timing of the winds is another component here, that certainly if we start the melt season early, it'd be interesting if there's any impacts on the atmospheric circulation, which is the controlling factor on whether this fresh water gets out into the interior North Atlantic.
Nicholas Fokel is an assistant professor at the University of Georgia's Skidaway Institute of Oceanography. The next FIFA World Cup starts exactly 1 year from today in Mexico City. The 2026 soccer tournament will be jointly hosted by Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. But there's already been some drama with a big upset in the Asian regional qualifiers.
The national football team of Palestine was seconds away from securing its first ever spot at the World Cup when its hopes were dashed by Oman. After 96 minutes of play, the score was sitting at 1-0, with the only goal scored by Ode Karoub for Palestine at the start of the second half.
Kayed to take it here as he whips it towards a near post, and it ends up in the back of the net. It's Karoub with the header, 4-1-0.
And that score held until the 97th minute, until the whistle blew for a foul called on the Palestine team.
As the ball is thrown forward and Al-Hassani goes down, and it's a foul, it's a penalty. Late drama as the penalty is awarded with seconds to go.
That gave Oman a free kick.
Issam Al-Sabi then steps up and slots it home for the equaliser. Oman snatched the playoff place away from Palestine with that late penalty, 97th minute.
The match ended in a tie, and sadly for Palestine, they needed a win to qualify for next year's World Cup.
The match took place in Amman, Jordan. Palestine has a home stadium outside of Jerusalem in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, but it has not hosted a match there since 2019. Hey there, it's Marco Werman along with Carolyn Beeler, your hosts.
We hope you think that the journalism we do adds something to your life. Maybe it helps you understand the world around you a little bit better, or sparks your curiosity about a place you've never been before.
We're able to bring you critical reporting about news and current affairs around the globe because listeners like you support the work of our newsroom. From now until June 30th, we have a goal of raising $25,000, and we're hoping you can help us reach it.
Thanks to a generous donor who has already stepped up to give, your donations will be matched 2-to-1. That means if you give $25, we get $75. A $100 donation means we'll have $300 in the bank to fund our journalism. Whatever amount you can give helps us bring you news from around the globe 5 days a week.
We hope you will seriously consider supporting our work. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Or use the link in the episode notes to donate.
Thank you so much from everyone here at The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The UK government has slapped sanctions on two members of Israel's cabinet. Canada, Norway, Australia, and New Zealand are also joining those sanctions. They're aimed at Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, Israel's ministers of security and finance, respectively. Both live in Jewish settlements in the West Bank, and both have said Palestinians should be expelled from there. Aaron David Miller was a longtime advisor on Arab-Israeli affairs at the State Department. We asked him how unusual these sanctions are.
I mean, I think they're unprecedented. It reflects the mounting frustration on the part of the Europeans, not just in Gaza. There's no doubt that these were intended somehow to get the Israelis' attention, to ease up and start facilitating humanitarian assistance in a way that could actually meet the dire needs of the population of Gaza. I would not call this, Marco, a profile in courage. I think if you looked at the last 18 months, the international community and the three countries in Europe that the Israelis care most about, the Brits, the French, and the Germans, that clearly hasn't been a profile in courage. I mean, the international community has been divided. It's feckless. It's self-interested in the face of a critical impasse between Israel and Hamas, which no outside mediator to this day, including the Biden and the Trump administration, has been willing and able to break.
Yeah, so what then is the point of these sanctions, and why did these countries reach this decision now?
Well, you know, domestic politics is one answer. Keir Starmer is a former human rights lawyer. He's clearly been under pressure from the Labour Party. There have been petitions by hundreds of British intellectuals and lawyers protesting British policy. Last fall, I think they suspended 39 export licenses of military equipment to Israel, but I think the total number was in the range of 350. So the British-Israeli military relationship is going to continue. But by and large, I think the international community outside of the International Criminal Court and the ICJ have really not risen to the challenge. And again, I think it demonstrates with a terrifying clarity the reality in an existential conflict when both sides, in this case, Hamas, clearly existential. In Netanyahu's case, it's politically existential. In such a conflict, it's very, very hard for outside parties, even America's closest ally, to do things that would fundamentally alter the trajectory, let alone solve the conflict.
How would you define the challenge those countries face with Israel right now?
The sanctions on Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, I think they're important. I mean, these are two ideologues spouting racist ideology. They are members of a democratically elected government presided over by a prime minister who was forced to rely on them in order to make sure that he maintains himself in power. He's on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in Jerusalem District Court. If he loses power, he could conceivably be convicted or have to cut a plea agreement, which would drive him out of power. So I think there are options open to the Europeans, but I think the Brits, the French, and the Germans clearly don't want to directly confront the government of Israel. So sanctions on Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, it's virtue signaling, it's performative in many respects, and it's a sort of trying to find the balance between doing nothing on one hand and directly confronting the government of Israel on the other. All of these governments, the Germans in particular, are really sensitive to accusations of anti-Semitism. You've just seen in the United States, right, the attack at the Capitol Museum in Washington and then the attack in Boulder, Colorado. They are very sensitive to that as well. So
right.
They're also dealing with political realities.
How are Israeli officials reacting to the news of these sanctions?
It's interesting because the centrist, Benny Gantz, who was a putative prime ministerial candidate,
former defense minister before he left the cabinet,
has actually come out with a very strong statement against what the four countries plus Norway, not a member of the EU, but still important to the Israelis, and Gideon Saar, who's now the Israeli foreign minister, blasted the sanctions and then vowed to consider how the Israelis are going to respond. I really do think, though, that there's a great concern on the part of people like Saar and Gantz that if, in fact, you can open the door by sanctioning Ben-Gvir and freezing their assets, and more important, the travel ban, that in effect the door is now open or could be open to sanctioning other ministers in the government. I doubt if Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are going to be traveling anywhere in Europe for the foreseeable future.
What sort of practical impact do these sanctions have on Ben-Gvir and Smotrich personally?
I don't think they have any impact. In the case of Ben-Gvir, who is really the keeper here, if elections were held, it is more than likely that Ben-Gvir and his party is going to gain rather than lose seats. It certainly boosts their brand and their cred within Israel. And I think that, frankly, for them and keeping Netanyahu from signing any sort of permanent end to the war and pursuing annexationist policy on the West Bank in everything but name and probably even including in name, those are their priorities. I don't think they care much about the Europeans.
So, I mean, are you seeing countries in the EU basically reassessing how they need to proceed with their Israel policy apart from the U.S.?
The Brits, I'm sure, previewed with the administration what they intended to do. The report I saw reported that the administration had no quote-unquote strong objections to what the Brits were going to do. But you also haven't seen a huge effort on the part of the administration to fundamentally distance themselves. I think the Europeans, from the beginning of the Trump administration, have concluded that they have to chart their own course, in many respects, irrespective of what the United States is going to do on so many issues from Gaza, particularly with respect to Ukraine.
So bringing back to the sanctions news, I mean, sanctions, they're a diplomatic tool that apply pressure in order to get a change of policy. What effect will these European sanctions have on Israeli actions, do you think?
I don't think they'll have any effect. Prime Minister of Israel, if he's responsive to pressure, he is caught between these two, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, without whose participation in his government, you'd either have new elections or a reconstitution of the government with someone else's prime minister on one hand and pressure from Donald Trump on the other. What I might see in days and weeks ahead, Trump is increasingly serious, not only about ensuring that the Israelis don't take military action against Iran until he's persuaded that diplomacy and negotiations cannot possibly work, but I think that the president increasingly wants to see an end to the war in Gaza. And the real question is he prepared to create an or else moment for Benjamin Netanyahu? We'll see.
So it kind of sounds like you're saying, Aaron David Miller, that these countries in Europe kind of had to do this per their own values and lifting up what you said about not a profile in courage. They just waited a really long time to do it.
I think that's right. And I think not far behind was increasing European alarm over the humanitarian situation in Gaza. And that, it seems to me, not the West Bank. Hmm. If there are additional sanctions or a fundamental change in policy on the part of the Europeans, it will be directed at using that as a lever to get the government of Israel to alter its policy on facilitating humanitarian assistance in Gaza in a way that can have it surge in an orderly fashion.
Aaron David Miller was a longtime advisor on Arab-Israeli affairs for multiple secretaries of state. He's a senior fellow now at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
More global news and stories are still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Here are a few of the top global stories we're following today.
Russia's military has launched another large-scale drone assault across Ukraine, killing three people and wounding 64 others in Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv. Russian forces hit apartment buildings, playgrounds, and public transportation, deploying a large number of drones and missiles in recent days. On Monday, Russia launched almost 500 drones at Ukraine, and early Tuesday sent a wave of over 300 drones and 7 missiles bombarding the country overnight.
In South Africa, at least 49 people have died in flooding, according to officials. An extreme cold front brought heavy rain and snow to parts of the Eastern Cape province. Power outages have affected hundreds of thousands of homes, and floodwaters have submerged houses and carried away cars. Eastern Cape Premier Oscar Maboyani said today, "I have never seen something like this."
Monitoring agencies say Taiwan was struck by an earthquake around 7 o'clock this evening, local time. Buildings in the capital of Taipei shook for about a minute, even though the epicenter was more than 150 miles away. There were no immediate reports of major damage.
And Austria has begun 3 days of mourning after that school shooting yesterday that killed 10 people. Attacks like this are rare in Austria, and it spurred debates over the country's gun laws, which are looser compared to other countries in the European Union. Investigators have not named the shooter's motive. The shooter also took his own life after staging the attack.
Follow more international headlines on our website. We're at theworld.org.
In Haiti, gang violence has driven more than a million people from their homes as they've fled to other parts of the country. Since the start of the year, tens of thousands of Haitians have been on the move as gangs continue to expand their control. With no end in sight to the violence, those internally displaced people are simply trying to cope with daily life in a country where there's little support for them. But in one small town in northern Haiti, reporter Amy Bracken met a pastor who's helping displaced people get back on their feet.
Pastor Joseph Patrice Aristom has only spent a few years here in Quartier-Morin on Haiti's north coast. He was born and raised in a small working-class community near the capital, Port-au-Prince. He was well established there with his own church and dedicated congregation. But then, an American missionary said he had a vision of Aristom working as a pastor here, 140 miles away. Aristom took this vision to heart. He spoke with his wife, prayed about it, and determined God wanted him to make this move, even though he didn't understand why. Starting in 2020, he moved his family, built a church called Grace Gathering, and recruited members. And in April 2023, an unexpected group of visitors arrived. I saw a bus letting people off, about 30 adults and children, he tells me. I said, what's going on? They told me the place we live, gangs took it over. They killed 1,000, 200, 300 people. They burned homes with people inside. They decapitated people. They shot people. This group fled. They were from Aristom's old congregation in his old community, Susmatla. Some had come on mission with him here, so they knew where to find him. The massacre in Susmatla shocked the country, but the exact toll is hard to find. The UN said in a preliminary report that at least 100 were killed and almost 4,000 displaced. Aristom calls these extreme undercounts. He says he personally knows more than 100 who were killed, and they include close friends and family. In my house, he says, we spent 2 or 3 weeks crying. The water couldn't stay in our eyes. There had already been a trickle of refugees arriving here from Susmatla in 2022, after the gangs made their first attacks in the area. But the April 23 attack triggered an exodus.
Ça va, c'est non, premier jour, le mois d'avril. Et puis, au jour le jour, mon âme vini.
After that first day in April, from one day to the next, people came, Aristom says. In about 2 weeks, there were some 350 people here with me. When I visit in the spring of 2025, 60 are still here. Some move out when they get the means to rent somewhere, but more keep coming. Those displaced again when gangs attack the place they had fled to. Those people over there, he says, they arrived recently. A mother and children lie on a blanket on the cement floor of the church's main chamber, a large, bare-bones space. He points around the building and starts taking me on a tour. He says there are people living in all the rooms of the church. That part is the church office. I have people living in there, he says. And in my house, there are more than 13 people, plus my family. So we're living in conditions that aren't acceptable. Some background. Gang violence in Haiti has been on the rise for several years, especially since 2021, when President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated. And now the gangs work together to prey on the population. They make money from extortion, kidnapping, and drug trafficking, facilitated by arms from the U.S. But the brutality is beyond comprehension. Susmatla was not the first massacre. But residents didn't realize they were in so much danger. We could see the ravaging of Port-au-Prince, Dashko Roberto Joseph tells me, but we never imagined it would come to our homes. Joseph is a family friend and relative of Pastor Aristome. She moved here after one of the attacks. She tells me we lived at ease as a family. Everyone knew everyone. We had no problems. Until one morning we awoke and the gangs had invaded and everyone was running. Of course, it wasn't the first time tragedy had struck Susmatla.
While the widespread damage is still being assessed, authorities are struggling to reach people who are still trapped in the rubble.
The 2010 earthquake destroyed many homes in the community. Pastor Aristome says there were people in Susmatla who were displaced by the earthquake. But afterwards, everyone returned home. They went back to living their lives, to start recovering. Now it's different. Because of the current insecurity, people don't believe they'll be able to return home, he says. Things are getting more difficult. The gangs are getting meaner. We feel that God alone can give us hope because we don't have a state, a government, or foreigners doing things for us. He says Susmatla is a no-go zone now. Cartier-Morin, by contrast, feels safe. But the downside is that the new arrivals don't know anyone here. It puts a lot of pressure on Pastor Aristome as he tries to provide material and spiritual support. He says, I realized that God had me leave my home down there to move here, to prepare for those people to come, so they wouldn't just be left to fend for themselves. He tries to help them meet basic needs, including food, getting their children into school, and searching for housing. He also gives some residents small loans so they can buy and sell goods from the Dominican Republic. He does all this with the salary he gets from an affiliated church in Indiana and with support from organizations and neighbors. But he says the situation is extremely hard. Dashka! For Dashka Joseph, who was 27, losing her career was a major blow. She was among very few people in Susmatla to go to college and became the community's only dentist. Aristome helped put Joseph through school and eventually open her own clinic in Susmatla. I wish I could get my clinic back, she says. I lost all my materials. I miss it so much. She's trying to rebuild her practice bit by bit. Her patient is lying on a lawn chair in the church, a small bag of water in her hand for rinsing. Joseph has cared for dozens of residents here. She often does cleanings and sometimes pulls teeth or applies braces. Patients pay when they're able. Other kinds of health care are extremely hard to access, and psychological trauma is a big concern. Aristome says he's tried in vain to find a psychologist who can come and talk to people. Meanwhile, he looks for ways to lift spirits. I try to create leisure activities for them, he says. And when we preach about peace and joy. He takes groups to nearby historical sites and to the beach. And Dashko Joseph and others put together activities like dance and fashion shows. Back in the church, as Joseph treats patients, singing practice starts in the next room. I realize they're singing Happy Birthday, and Aristome tells me the church celebrates all the residents' birthdays by month, which feels fitting. He talks to residents about the process of starting over and about the significance of God saving them, not in a born-again way, but in that they survived something terrible, and they must make the most of this life. Automatically, bon Dieu fait au kembe ou gen vie. Since God saved you, you can start again, he says. It will be hard at first, and then, when you've recovered and God blesses you, you grow. You grow where you are. For the world, I'm Amy Bracken, Cartier-Morin, Haiti.
Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, took the stand this week in a high-stakes trial. He's facing charges that he oversaw a vast scheme to cling to power after losing the 2022 elections. Bolsonaro testified before the Supreme Court yesterday and denied participating in a coup.
Golpe, eu fico até arrepiado quando se fala que o janeiro foi golpe. Aquelas 1,500 pessoas.
Bolsonaro told the court he gets goosebumps when people call the insurrection of January 8, 2023 a coup, but he admitted that he did look for constitutional ways to question the election results from a few months earlier. Rafael Lloris teaches Latin American history and politics at the University of Denver. He told us about the charges against Bolsonaro and his allies.
So what happened in Brazil in January 2023 was a similar event that happened in the United States, of course, after the loss of the attempted re-election of Donald Trump and the victory of Joe Biden. So they invaded the Congress and the presidential palace and the Supreme Court in Brazil, which are all, you know, in the same square in the city of Brasilia. So since then, the Supreme Court took as its main role regarding this issue, you know, to investigate what happened there. So and now it came the time of the plotters, the brains behind the operation. That includes the former president Bolsonaro, the candidate who is in jail now, a general, Braga Neto, that was running on the ticket for the re-election of Bolsonaro, that was also behind this, and other advisors, including two other generals. So they've been tried for this attempted insurrection, attempted coup. The trial now has been handled by the Supreme Court, and they had, you know, the chance now to present their case yesterday in Brazil.
So Bolsonaro was in Florida during the attempted insurrection on the 8th of January, 2023. How has the prosecution gone about trying to prove Bolsonaro was behind a coup attempt?
They found different documents in different people's houses, including another general who's in trial now, Heleno, who was a key figure in the government of Bolsonaro when he was in power, which is called, like, you know, the plan for the coup. That's the name even of the document they found in different people's computers and different printed, you know, documents in people's houses. So they were not all that smart.
That is literally the title of the document, the plan for the coup?
Yes. Yes. It's exactly what's called, you know, Minuta do Golpe, the plan for the coup. And now, of course, Bolsonaro is saying that, of course, you know, there was an argument that he never saw that document. And people say, well, you know, people are saying that they showed it to you. Now he's saying, yes, that he saw it, but he never signed it. Of course, now this is up to the Supreme Court to decide if that's a valid argument or not. Seems that they have enough evidence, you know, people's depositions and documents to say that, well, you cannot claim that you were not aware of things and somehow gave a green light, even if you didn't sign it. But, you know, something that's going to still be decided.
Yeah, I mean, Bolsonaro says he had no contact with the insurrectionists. Yesterday, he described them to the Supreme Court as a bunch of crazies. What is your understanding, Rafael, of the scope of the relationship between the insurrectionists and Bolsonaro?
Many people, supporters of Bolsonaro, close supporters of Bolsonaro, among them, many people demanding a military coup in Brazil, went to the streets and they went close to many barracks throughout the country, demanding the military to intervene, demanding the military to act. Again, let's remember, Bolsonaro is a former military man, and he's surrounded by himself with many, many important generals and other military officers in his government. People were saying, you know, we are here on behalf of officers that say if we just create this sort of demand, they will act. Many of them are now frustrated, first of all, because they never acted, you know, even though they were surrounded as barracks and demanding them to act. And now Bolsonaro, of course, called them crazy. So we'll see what happened now. Some people are feeling betrayed. Of course, many people continue to support Bolsonaro and sort of the wider conservative reactionary authoritarian movement in Brazil, which is called Bolsonarismo.
And how widespread is that support today in Brazil?
Conservative forces are very, very strong in Brazil today. It's a moment when Brazil has a widespread sense of, you know, conservative ideas on the rise and sustained support. So it's not necessarily all that people feel themselves at this point, you know, as supporters of Bolsonaro himself, but supporters of many of the positions that his government has presented to the country in the last few years.
I mean, if it is 30% support for Bolsonaro, is that a surprisingly high number for a former president charged with staging a coup?
It's a concerning number, not necessarily surprising, because you know, Bolsonaro was elected in 2018 with, you know, wide margins and only lost very close to Lula in 2022, a few percentage points.
Do most Brazilians have faith in their judicial system?
Traditionally, yes. The judiciary in Brazil, judicial branch, remember that it's, you know, a very conservative, traditional, I would even say elitist institution, you know, not necessarily in a sharing progressive ideas or with social progressive, you know, positions, legal positions. But there's a wide, you know, sense that they, again, they're not, most of them, besides the Supreme Court, are not politically appointed. They are all, you know, career judges that have to take an entrance exam. So they're seen as sort of technocrats, you know, working to abide by the legal system, which is very rigid. You know, remember, it's a Roman law tradition, so laws are much more detailed than in the United States.
A coup conviction could mean more than a decade in prison for Bolsonaro. What sort of political future does he have, prison time or not?
Well, that would be the first time that a president in Brazil, a former president in Brazil, would be, he's been tried and maybe, you know, sentenced to jail for attempted coup, a country that has had, you know, unfortunately, other coups in its past, and would be, if I may, be the first time that generals would be, you know, are being brought to trial and maybe, you know, sentenced into prison. So I think there's a huge significance to this trial. Again, there's always a possibility that they may be sentenced, but would only serve, you know, the sentence or part of the sentence at home. You know, they're old. I mean, there's always this possibility that things will be nuanced and softened. But nonetheless, I think it would be a very important, you know, historic, symbolically important, but also important to in terms of rule of law and democratic institutions in Brazil, if there's a fair trial, if they are sentenced, and of course, if they serve at least part of the sentence.
Rafael Yuriz teaches Latin American history and politics at the University of Denver. He's been speaking with us about the trial of Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, who's accused of plotting a coup in 2023 to stay in power.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Dads pushing strollers on a picket line, not the most common sight, but that's what's happened today in London and Edinburgh as fathers went on what they're calling a dad strike, one of their main demands to spend more time with their newborns. Britain offers just 2 weeks of paid paternity leave, which campaigners say is the worst in all of Europe. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
Twinkle, twinkle, time flies fast. Make the moments with dad last.
Hundreds of dads, some with babies strapped to their chests, gathered outside the Department of Business and Trade in central London this afternoon. Many were carrying makeshift signs with messages like, worst dad joke ever, the UK's paternity leave. Lee Wilcox, a dad of two from Birmingham, tells me when his first child was born, he took just 2 weeks off.
So tough, especially that, you know, the second time round's not as bad in my mind because I kind of knew what was coming, but first time round, you know, you don't have a clue and it's hard. It's really hard.
Today's protest was organised by the campaign group The Dad Shift. Its co-founder, George Gabriel, says when his daughter Cal was born, he had no idea what he was doing either.
My daughter was the first baby I ever really helped. She was certainly the first one whose nappy I changed or who I fed and burped. And just, you know, honestly, those first couple of weeks, I was really bad at it.
But he was lucky, he says. His employer gave him 4 months paternity leave, fully paid. And that turned out to be critical for Gabriel and his partner. When Cal was just 5 weeks old, she suffered a brain injury.
We rushed into hospital and spent the next 5 days and nights there under observation. It was some of the toughest time of my life. One thing I didn't have to worry about was work.
Most dads and non-birthing parents in the UK are back at work within a fortnight because they feel they don't have a choice, he says. Marvin Harrison was one of them.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Dope Black Dads podcast. I'm Marvin Harrison, and today we are delving into a topic that's both vital and often overlooked in our community. It's mental health.
Harrison talks about everything related to black dads and fatherhood on his podcast. 8 years ago, though, after his second child was born, he found it hard to admit to anyone that he was really struggling. Eventually, he sent a WhatsApp message to a group of fellow dads saying that he felt he was failing at fatherhood. And their reaction took him by surprise.
I thought more men were handling it all. And then I realised there's a constant sense of failure between men and our ability to provide, but also our ability to be great partners and fathers.
And part of the problem is just having the time to really be with your kids right from the start, he says. In Spain, new dads get 16 weeks off work on full pay. In Sweden, parents are entitled to 480 days of paid leave. A government spokesperson said today they recognise the system needs to be improved and a review will be carried out soon. Birmingham dad Lee Wilcox runs a platform for tradespeople called On the Tools. Most tradespeople are self-employed and don't take any parental leave, he says. Wilcox met with the government representative this afternoon and says he's actually feeling optimistic.
I do think some change will come. And the good thing, right, is that for self-employed people at the minute, it's at zero. So the improvement doesn't need to be huge in order for that to make a difference to people's lives.
I'm an employer too, he says, and I want to give parents more time off when they have kids. But the British government has to step up and play its part too, he says. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
They're back. I'm talking about boy band BTS, the K-pop sensation. Boys no more, with all the members due to be discharged from Korean military service by the end of the month, a reunion is imminent. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
BTS fans are seriously losing their minds. Jimin and Jungkook, the most popular members, and that is only a semi-controversial opinion, were discharged yesterday. Then it was straight to a press conference near the base. Just the day before, two other members, V and RM, were discharged. RM broke out his saxophone. He was in the military band during his enlistment. And V smiled big and spoke to the hundreds of screaming, crying, flag-waving fans who showed up to welcome them back to civilian life. To all the army who have waited for us. Army is the official name for the millions of BTS fans. To all the army, I am truly grateful, he says. Please wait just a little longer, and we'll return with a really cool performance. Fans from all over the world flew over, even though the record label told them not to, safety concerns and all. Like Daphne, who spoke to Reuters.
We flew, like, from Brazil to here just to support them and all this comeback. And finally, they are free to be themselves and to be with us again.
And Anaïsi, who made the 20-hour trip from Portugal.
BTS is everything for me because I'm suffering for depression. So the first time I see BTS, it saved me. So for me, BTS is my angel.
Men in South Korea have to do a year and a half of military service, usually in their late teens or early 20s, K-pop stars included. Now only Suga is still in the army. He gets out later this month. In 2022, when the label announced that all seven members would be going into the military, the fans went into collective mourning. Would this enlistment be the end of the road? But the label managed to stagger the enlistments. So while some members served, others were releasing solo albums and going on tour to keep the fans engaged. Jungkook did a surprise concert in Times Square in November 2023.
Hey, New York City!
The police had to barricade 7th Avenue.
BTS, that's that point.
J-Hope did a world tour in March. This song, Mona Lisa, has more than 130 million streams on Spotify. Through the long deployment, the BTS Army stayed true. They called themselves military spouses, only kind of joking, and posted crying selfies on Twitter, hashtag BTS, hashtag support our troops. And now the actual reunion is upon us. No exact date yet, but the comeback is slated for sometime this year. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nen and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
Find us online anytime at theworld.org and starting Monday, find our original reporting on YouTube. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.